Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
This is Mary Robson with Nature Now for the first week of spring. Spring buds beginning their bloom, trillium leaves just emerging, blue, blue skies. I said to a Port Townsend walker, "Great day for us," and he replied, "We deserve it." Today, most unusually, all members of the Nature Now team share this show. Founder Kate Dwyer, who thought of Nature Now and started it, is doing the interview. Debron Kelso and Mary Robson are helping with observations. Nan Evans just contributes steady help, and Alex Henley is here to help us on reading and engineering. We always start with the mystery sound. Would you be surprised if we didn't have one? Here's a clue about today's mystery sound. This animal prefers not to be seen. And now some observations with some help from Alex.
Debron Kelso writes that she saw not only one, but two eastern gray squirrels out in her neighborhood a few days ago. The first pair she's seen out of the woods west of Port Townsend. It's never good news when you see a pair of any exotic species, as the next thing you know, you have a whole population of animals that should never be there. Her neighbors said that they had seen a pair near their place last year, so hopefully they're the same animals and not an additional pair. The eastern gray squirrel is from the deciduous and coniferous forests of eastern North America and was introduced into city parks, campuses, and estates in Washington in the early 1900s. Since then, they have gradually been expanding their range into more rural areas. It is not clear whether they have been having a negative impact upon our native species, but what is clear is that our native species is now threatened due to habitat loss. In western Washington, they now only occur in remnant patches of oak pine forest in the South Puget Trough. Mary says that her woods near Discovery Bay have two native squirrels looking healthy. Unfortunately, the eastern gray has colonized Chetsamoka Park.
Now for another observation from Deborah. This is Newt News. And Deborah writes, "It is time to start keeping a sharp eye out on the roads, as one of our favorite creatures, the rough-skinned newt, has been starting to cross the roads in increasing numbers on their way to their breeding ponds." Last week, Nature Now's guest Bob Jepperson told a fascinating story about how red-legged frogs had also been crossing the roads to breeding ponds back in February, and then crossed back again into the cover of the woods when we got our big snowstorms. I was wondering what the newts did in these situations. The newts are so much slower crossing the roads than the frogs are. It is no mean feat for them to make a return journey. I asked my neighbor, Jeff Hammerson, who knows a lot about amphibians, and he said that what usually happens is that the newts will just drop to the bottom of the pond to wait out the freeze, emerging to continue the breeding season when it warms up again.
The astronomical changes sweep towards us and away quickly. One welcome change is the spring equinox occurring this year on Wednesday, March 20th, at around 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Whatever that means, it's moved an hour. The rest of this week is the first days of astronomical spring. The vernal equinox in the northern hemisphere is the fall equinox in the southern hemisphere. March equinox marks the moment the sun crosses the celestial equator, imaginary line in the sky above the Earth's equator, from south to north. On the equinoxes, the sun shines directly on the equator. Another way to express it is that the sun and the equator are on the same plane. The length of day and night is nearly equal, but not quite, because of latitude and light angles.
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of Nature Now. I'm your host, Kate Dwyer. Today's show is going to delve into the natural history collection and files at the Jefferson County Historical Society. My guest is Becky Sherman, who is the collections manager at the Resource Center. Becky took me on a recent tour of the facility focusing on their natural history collection. Welcome to Nature Now, Becky.
Thanks, Kate.
So let's start with, what does a collections manager do? What's your job description?
In this institution, as collections manager, I'm responsible for the storage facilities, and I accession and take care of all three-dimensional artifacts. We have another person who takes care of the paper.
I see. And that's a big building, too.
It is. Yeah. A lot of stuff.
Yeah, it was fun to go there. Let's start with the collections mania. I'd like to know why people collected the way they did and how these things ended up in museums and so forth.
Well, let me start with a little history of collecting. There is an etched image from the late 1500s that shows one of the first cabinet of curiosities, mm-hmm. or they were sometimes called cabinet of wonders, which really meant it wasn't a piece of furniture. It was a room that was filled with all kinds of natural and sometimes unnatural objects. And I think in general, over time, people collected because they were curious and they were scientific, or they collected to show off their social standing and their wealth. And this continued for a very long time until some of these collectors began to die. Then their collections were sold to either organizations or cities, which then housed them and opened them to the public. They then became some of the first museums in our society. This continued, and during the Victorian period, collecting became a mania again. And part of that was driven by what we call manifest destiny. They were absolutely convinced that the world was for their plucking, and it was not going to intimidate them. So they collected from all over. Some people who were actually scholars and interested, and other people who were just status seekers. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's bring that around to our region and some of the collections that we have, starting with the Bash family. And the Bash family were important here. Albert came here and was a collector of customs between 1881 and 1885. And that was a very prestigious and lucrative job. And he ended up bringing his whole family out here from the Midwest, including his father, who he gave the job of collections shipping commissioner. These jobs enabled them to, the word you use, pluck things from around the world. So let's start with, speaking of pluck, birds. Tell us about the Bash birds.
Albert, actually everyone in Albert's family were sportsmen, even the daughters. It was a very large family, and he had seen really wonderful birds while he was working in China, and he actually chose to ship, I believe, 40 or 50 birds here. He rented Protection Island.
Isn't that something?
I know, for his own use, and that became their private hunting preserve for years.
And this is the time period when the ringneck pheasants were introduced. Didn't he also breed those?
Yes, mm-hmm. he did. And he brought several different varieties of grouse.
And they're still breeding ringneck pheasants. I think a lot of people think pheasants are native, but no, they're Chinese.
They actually came from China, and they're still breeding and releasing them for hunting.
And then wasn't it another brother who did the taxidermy?
Yes, brother Frank was a taxidermist, and so he actually taxidermied both the exotics and birds from here. So in our collection, we have 25 taxidermied birds from his collection, 8 of which are exotics from China.
And they're very beautiful. I saw when I got to see them, I was impressed.
Well, they're very dramatic.
Yes, they are. And the other thing that was collected by Henry were shells. He would ask, or people would bring as favors, shells from all over the world. And your museum has ended up with them. So tell us about those.
Well, we do. We have a large shell and coral collection. There's over 126 pieces in that particular collection. And I think probably the most dramatic piece in that collection is a giant clam shell that was considered a man-eating clam from the Polynesian Islands. Uh-huh. And it's huge. It's like 3 feet wide. It's enormous.
Is it too heavy to pick up, for example, for you?
I can do it, but it's not safe.
Not
artifact handling.
Right.
It's really at least a two-person job with a spotter.
How did the museum end up with the Bash collection?
Actually, one of the daughters, Eva Bash Campbell, gave us all of those collections in 1951.
In terms of eggs, also somebody collected the little eggs and somebody preserved them. What's that story about?
Yeah. Well, this came from a family of pioneer farmers in Western Washington, and one of the sons, whose name was Leslie Bennett, was just very scholarly, and mm-hmm. he was a collector, and he collected native birds' eggs, mm-hmm. and he studied them, and he marked them in a particular way that would identify what they were. Mm-hmm. When I got them, I had no idea what they were and what the little markings meant. I had spoken to you, Kate, and mm-hmm. you knew someone at the bird, I re-photographed all those eggs and sent them there, and they were able to read the markings on the eggs and identify all but one egg as being native species here.
I see. And that was in the show that you had a couple years ago, the Cabinet of Curiosities.
That was the first time we used them, yes.
Right. And then to move on to mammals, how about Charlie? Tell us about Charlie.
Well, Charlie, who we also sometimes call Dusty, is a taxidermied cougar, and he's just enormous. So he was shot by Frank Smith in 1910. He had him taxidermied. He lived in a hotel on Water Street.
The Admiralty, is
it was the Admiralty. Uh-huh. You're right. Until it burned down, or maybe just before it burned down, because the hotel burned down, but Charlie didn't.
He just ran out.
He must have just left in time. In 1962, his wife gave him to us.
So after seeing the birds and the seashells and Charlie the cougar, I asked you if there was anything else in the natural history collection that we might look at. And I remember you had this twinkle in your eye and you said, do you want to see something creepy or something like that? So I said, of course I did. And since humans are animals, after all, we include the bizarre story of hair wreaths. Take it away, Bick.
Hair wreaths were very popular, again, during the Victorian period. And what women would do is take the hair from their dead children, husbands, relatives, and keep them all together in something called a hair keeper. And then at some point, the women in the family would begin to weave these hairs into extremely intricate flowers and leaves, either in a wreath shape or a U shape. They would add beads and special wires to mm-hmm. give them shape. They were then mounted in a glass shadow box and hung in the parlor. So,
jeez.
I know. So really, they became kind of a shrine for their dead family.
And didn't you tell me one time the U-shape faced up to face heaven? Was that the open end?
Oh, yes.
Faced?
If they were U-shaped, yes. Uh-huh. The points always faced toward heaven.
Of course.
Yes, of course.
Well, besides physical artifacts, the Resource Center, of course, has extensive files and documents, room after room. And using those and various books and personal correspondence, we will move on to the surprising subject of reindeer. My curiosity was aroused by an undated photo in a book and in the collection that said a group of young women on Water Street in Port Townsend in the 19th century and dressed in their ethnic clothes. And the caption said, Laplanders from Finland on their way to Alaska to teach reindeer husbandry. What, I wondered, were they doing in Port Townsend?
I do remember something about someone in the Hastings family taking reindeer to Siberia.
That perplexed me because I thought that they took the reindeer from Siberia to Alaska, not from Alaska to Siberia. So I looked into it. Well, the Hastings family descendants are still here. And being not a real historian and kind of lazy, I just wrote to them and asked them about it rather than spending days going through all these files. And sure enough, they wrote back. Captain Harry Dudley told me this story. He's a U.S. Coast Guard retired who lives here. Their grandfather, Lieutenant Harry Hamlet, who passed through Port Townsend on two extraordinary missions, had to do with these reindeers. While here, he met Francis Hastings, whom he eventually married. Lieutenant Hamlet was aboard two ships on rescue missions. The Overland Relief Expedition stopped in Port Townsend on its way to rescue 275 whalers who were starving, trapped in the ice at Point Barrow. They were able to herd many, many reindeer to them to feed them and save the day. The other mission went the other way. That is, Lieutenant Hamlet's ship brought reindeer that had been domesticated in Alaska to Siberia around 1900. A Siberian village was starving because their reindeer herd had been decimated. In gratitude, Tsar Nicholas II presented the lieutenant with a Fabergé cigarette box with the Tsar's crest. The Dudley Hastings family still has this treasure. So Becky was right. They were taking, it was a Hastings family member, and they were taking them from Alaska to Siberia. So what about that photo of the Sami girls on Water Street?
Well, in the late 19th century, reindeer were introduced from Siberia to Alaska as a source of food, clothing, and other necessities for the native people. Reindeer, it turns out, were simply domesticated caribou. The problem with the plan was that the Alaska natives did not know how to domesticate and herd reindeer. So Sami people, then called Laplanders, were brought from Finland and Siberia to Alaska to teach reindeer husbandry. The photo proves some Sami spent at least some time in Port Townsend, and we know a large group camped at the Seattle Woodland Park Zoo while en route, causing quite a sensation.
Becky, thanks so much for letting us into your treasure trove. I've got to ask two questions that have nothing to do with natural history. Do you have a favorite or most precious item in the collection?
I don't have just one. As we unpack our collection and rehouse them in permanent storage, I find things in all of our different areas of collections, like organics and furniture and art, that just are dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. So I have lots.
You love your job, don't you?
I do, actually.
And my other question is, are the hair wreaths the weirdest thing at the Resource Center?
I don't think so.
No? What's weirder?
Well, to me at least, I think what's even creepier are all the old, old medical equipment that we have.
Yeah, yeah, like how to pull your teeth out.
Keep your eyes open.
Okay, we don't say no more.
All right, I won't.
Well, thanks, Becky, for this peek into the Resource Center. It's been fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Hi, our mystery sound, you may not be surprised to hear this, is a cougar. Cougars hiss, purr, mew, growl, yowl, chirp, and cry. The most sensational sounds they make are the eerie wailings and moans heard at night during mating season, especially when competing males have intentions toward the same receptive female. Such wails have been likened to a child crying, a woman's scream, and the screeching of someone in terrible pain. Cougars use steep canyons, rock outcroppings and boulders, or vegetation, such as dense brush and forests, to remain hidden while hunting.
Adult male cougars roam widely, covering a home range of 50 to 150 square miles, depending on the age of the cougar, the time of the year, the type of terrain, and availability of prey. These home ranges will often overlap those of three or four females. Female home ranges are about half that of males, and there is considerable overlap in female home ranges. Often female progeny will establish a territory adjacent to the mother, while virtually all males disperse considerable distances from the natal area. A large male cougar living in the Cascade Mountain kills a deer or elk every 9 to 12 days, eating up to 20 pounds at a time and burying the rest for later. Except for females with the young, cougars are lone hunters that wander between places frequented by their prey, covering as much as 15 miles in a single night.
That information came from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife.
All are welcome to a bird walk in the spring season, Saturday, March 23rd, 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. This is at the Dungeness River Audubon Center, out by the Railroad Bridge Park.
The book discussion group for the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is sharing a book written by John Marsloff in 2015 and recently reprinted. It is called Welcome to Suburbia, Sharing Our Neighborhoods with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. This might be a great present for someone who lives in the middle of a city. They are meeting at the Dungeness River Audubon Center March 26th, 2019 at 4 p.m. till 5 p.m. And again, the Dungeness River Audubon Center is parallel to the Railroad Park out in Squim. Bob Bokelhide is going to speak on Sunday, March 24th, on seabirds and marine mammals of Protection Island. The talk is at 3 p.m. in the Fort Warden Chapel.
Well, that's it for this spring-like week. We hope you've enjoyed your eclectic and vigorous show on local nature happenings. Nature Now airs on Wednesdays at noon and repeats on Thursdays at 5:05 and Saturdays at 12:30. You can also get podcasts of every show at www.kptz.org.
My tail in the air. Cat style.